From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, cold as ice, as U.S.-backed Israeli forces terrorize Gaza, reducing the tiny enclave to rubble. Donald Trump's paramilitary militia terrorizes Black, Brown, and Latino communities coast to coast. We speak with an organizer for anti-war and justice group, Code Pink, and two dozen Canadian senators call for a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel. We speak with one of them. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Months into Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, the death toll rising, famine has now been formally declared by the UN agency that declares such things, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. It's a worst-case scenario, the IPC declared at the end of July. No news for those who follow the media. Skeletal toddlers on TV screens and online news platforms day after day. It's not true, says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court. Israel's fast friends appear to be moved and are now declaring the horror show has to stop. Dangerous, they say. Inhumane. Unacceptable. Egregious. Outrageously unlawful? No. No Western state has gone that far. No mention of the G word or the A word. But a sea change seems to be underway in places you'd least expect. The UK, the Netherlands, Germany, and Canada. Longtime Israeli bro when Stephen Harper was prime minister. Justin Trudeau vowed a more nuanced Palestine-friendly policy. Trudeau's foreign minister, Chrystia Freeland, vowed Canada would be Israel's asset at the UN Security Council. In the Canadian Parliament, Mark Carney, now prime minister, sturdier voices are demanding justice and action. With me to talk about this is the Honorable Mary Lou McFedrin, Canadian senator from the province of Manitoba. In late June, Senator McFedrin and 10 of her colleagues called on Prime Minister Carney to uphold international law and hold Israel accountable. We reached Senator Mary Lou McFedrin on summer leave in British Columbia. Hello, Mary Lou McFedrin. Hello, Senator McFedrin. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor. Tell me about this statement that you folks, you and 10 of your colleagues, released on June 25th. And you've just told me that you've just today, the 29th day of July, just released another statement. But for the moment, tell me about the statement you released on 25th of June and what you're asking, respectfully, that Prime Minister Carney do.
I'd like to begin, David, by acknowledging the heartfelt, dedicated work of Senator Pau Wu of British Columbia on this issue, particularly with a focus on starving and murdered Palestinian children. Senator Wu was the host for the special rapporteur, the UN special rapporteur, Albanese, to come to the Senate. And it was at a time prior to our releasing the joint statement on June 25th, when I think it's fair to say that there was a level of concern, but not a level of action on the part of most of our colleagues in the Senate on this issue. And that is shifting. And as it happens, the 25th of June, the day we released the previous letter, because as you've mentioned, we've released another one today in the morning in Canada. And on the 25th of June, that turned out to be our last day in Parliament before the Prime Minister declared that we were adjourning for the summer. And those of us, the 11 of us who ended up signing that joint statement, and I'll just say that We don't get that many joint statements coming out of the Senate of Canada. There is a strong sense among many that the tradition of the Senate should have a somewhat removed positioning on the part of senators in Canada. We're referenced sometimes as being the place of sober second thought, being the place where there should be, as some people put it, some neutrality on issues until they've been carefully studied by senators. And that may be one of the reasons that a significant number of our colleagues, we now have over 100 sitting senators, and why a significant number of our colleagues may have felt concerned but were not prepared to put their names to this letter. The letter we released today has a more of a focus. The letter that we released at the on the last day of Parliament in June was very much geared to the need to tell more of the truth about what's really going on, and in particular to focus on the impact of children. We had come from a seminar where a number of non-governmental organizations, civil society leaders, focused on children, UNICEF being one, Save the Children being another, had come to the Senate. And we had quite a turnout. We had about 25 senators that showed up for this in-person briefing where they focused on ways in which Canada had spoken out and taken action to support children in Ukraine in the midst of that illegal war, and compared that to the relatively much less of both a response in words and a response in action and a response in funding when it came to Palestinian children, Gaza, children in Gaza. And that prompted us to do this joint statement to bring to the attention of the government of Canada that there needed to be much more action and many more resources directed to the children of Gaza. So that was the June statement. This statement, roughly a month later, is geared to calling attention to the government of Canada and to those who care about what the government of Canada is or should be doing in relation to Gaza, where our joint statement pointed out, and we built on a report that was also released this morning in Canada, basically contradicts what we've been told previously by officials representing Global Affairs Canada around what we've allowed in terms of arms and arms-related items to be sent to Israel, either routed through the U.S. to end up in Israel or sent directly to Israel.
Because Canada has a certain arms trading relationship with Israel, doesn't it? Canada sends arms and security equipment to Israel, and it receives arms and certain kinds of securitization technologies from Israel.
That's right. And also, Canada is a state party to the arms trade treaty. So we have no business in terms of our legal obligation to allow this to continue to happen. And part of what we as senators were raising in this joint release today was, and again, the focus was on children in Gaza, is on children in Gaza. But because of the new evidence, the carefully researched evidence that was released from the coalition of NGOs, we really wanted to weigh in on that, because of course, why do we have this escalating, this tragic and horrific escalation of the death of people in Gaza who are just trying to get food, and the disproportionate impact on children? So that, of course, it's related to military exports to Israel, and this report that was released today is a very clear demonstration of both complicit companies who were involved in this.
Canadian companies.
Canadian companies and Israeli companies. So it names Israeli companies that are receiving Canadian exports, military exports. And the research looked at the data tables for imports from Canada in Israel. And it covered from October 2023 to June of 2025. So very much up to date. And for the first time, complementary shipping records and government data provide the most detailed public snapshots to date of Canada's military support for Israel's assault on Gaza. And this evidence is a contradiction of what Canadian officials have been telling the world.
What military equipment is Canada sending to Israel?
It's not necessarily guns.
It's components.
It's,
I mean,
it's components.
Canada specializes in components, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the general term is military exports. And, you know, for me, I'm those details of exactly what those military exports are is really not the point here. The point is that there is documented evidence that what we were told, which was that we had stopped. The previous foreign minister said that we had stopped sending military exports to Israel.
That was Melanie Joly.
Yes, the previous foreign affairs minister. So now I think we have to look to the current foreign affairs minister, the Honorable Anita Anand, to see just what amount of honesty we're going to get from the government of Canada.
Can you give me a sense, Senator McFadden, like, do you have any understanding of specifically what kinds of components, military components, Canada is sending to Israel?
Well, the report from civil society, which we have as senators taken very seriously, the restricted arms exports to Israel, and what's listed here is 47 shipments with detailed commercial shipping records uncovered from manufacturers in Canada selling military-related components to Israeli weapons companies between October 2023 and July 2025, including 421,070 bullets exported to Israel, three shipments of cartridges from the General Dynamics Ordnance and Tactical Systems, and 391 shipments, including bullets, military equipment, weapons, parts, aircraft components, and communication devices.
Huh.
Huh.
So you've got six asks here on June 25th. Protect UNRWA, ensure that UNRWA is funded, imposing a two-way arms embargo on Israel. Okay, I think we've touched on that. End Canadian involvement in illegal Israeli settlements. I mean, Canada's official position is that settlements are unlawful. Canada's Foreign Affairs Canada's website has stated for years that Israeli settlements are in breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Therefore, they are a grave breach. Article 49.6, a war crime under the protocol additional. And an obstacle above all that to a two-state solution, which Canada has always embraced. And yet Canada end Canadian involvement in illegal Israeli settlements. Canada actually extends aid and assistance to the settlements, doesn't it?
Yes, and Canada also allows into Canada products that are manufactured in those illegal settlements.
It actually unbelievably extends favorable tariff treatment to those settlement products under the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement. And I know a little bit about this. As you know, I won't go into the whole full disclosure here, but I know for a fact that Canadian trade officials told the federal government years ago that the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement really doesn't cover settlements, but that was overruled. And so the long and the short is that the Canadian government actually extends favorable tariff treatment to settlement products, which is astonishing.
Well, and let me pick up on that, David, because from an inside the Senate perspective at the time that we were called upon to vote in favor of that trade agreement with Israel, working with Amnesty International, I proposed an amendment in the Senate. And I pointed out to my colleagues that other free trade agreements, the EU agreement being one example, but most of our free trade agreements actually have reference to human rights provisions. And most of our free trade agreements that Canada has with other entities, other countries, other entities, actually acknowledge that there needs to be a respect of our human rights obligations. And that was the amendment that I proposed, and it was overwhelmingly voted down.
So you think CFTA should be the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement? You say review the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement with a view to suspending or terminating it.
And with a view to amending it so that it's consistent with our other free trade agreements with provisions on human rights.
Should Israeli settlement products be banned from Canada?
We should be looking at that. I think if our actions are consistent with our words, we should be looking very seriously at that.
Should Canada state that it's going to honor the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants against Israeli leaders, Netanyahu and Gallant?
Yes.
Has Mark Carney said anything about this?
Not to my knowledge.
And do you have a position on this?
Canada, with the leadership at the time of the then Foreign Minister, Lloyd Axworthy, invested hugely in the Rome Statute and the creation of the International Criminal Court. And Canada has a leadership, historically a leadership role on how important it is to implement the Rome Statute. So to be consistent and to follow actions with our words with our actions, the answer has to be yes. In many ways, I'm seeing that world leaders, because we are watching as a world in real time, a genocide.
And you think it's a genocide?
I do think it's a genocide, yes. Because we are watching it every day. And I think, you know, the senators, and by the way, this joint statement that was released today by senators more than doubled in the number of senators that signed on to the joint statement.
There's now something like 24.
Yes, that's right. And across the spectrum. So it's agonizingly slow, given the deaths and given the deprivation and given the starvation. But there is a shift that is in process. I hope, as one of the senators who's spoken on this issue for quite a long time now, that as this evidence mounts, if you're going to listen to any reliable news, if you're going to watch any reliable news, you have to know that you're being a witness to genocide.
So can you briefly tell me this statement that was issued today, Senator McFedrin, with like 24 senators? What does it say in a nutshell?
Well, today we have focused on arms. We've addressed the fact that Canada has legal obligations as a state party to the Arms Trade Treaty, because it is clear that there is a substantial risk that these military exports, as they're called, will be and could be used by Israel, and that the occupation and the war on Gaza is not legal. We also, at the end of our joint statement, just point out a very practical truth, which is our government cannot control how or where Israel uses the military exports once they leave Canada. So having officials of the government say to us, we're pretty sure that they're not going to be used, or we haven't had it verified that they're being used, that's not sufficient. So what we've called for is a full an immediate arms embargo against Israel under Canada's sanctions legislation. And we have said, as the closing statement in our joint letter today, anything less is a betrayal of our international commitments and of the universal human rights that Canadians expect us to uphold. So we're certainly hoping that the Prime Minister has read this joint statement by senators. We're certainly hoping that members of Parliament are open to making similar joint statements. I'll know more after we have this meeting, about 10 minutes from now, with Canadian parliamentarians focused on the situation in Palestine. There has to be a tipping point. As human beings, there has to be a tipping point. I feel heartbreak at the stress in relationships with Jewish colleagues who have declared themselves Zionist, who have declared themselves unprepared to question Israel as a state, as a country. I think we have a lot of distance yet to go as parliamentarians, and I think we are approaching a tipping point on that. I don't control that. I can only articulate my knowledge, my concerns, and as we've done with this letter and the previous letter last month, create an opportunity for senators in particular, but parliamentarians in general, to be more aware and, frankly, to be more honest about what's going on.
Senator Mary Lou McFedrin, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor. It's been a pleasure.
David, thank you for your dedication and for contributing to the crucial role of independent media in our world.
The Honorable Mary Lou McFedrin is a Canadian lawyer and human rights advocate. She was the dean of the University of Winnipeg's Global College in Manitoba between 2008 and 2012 and has been a member of the Senate of Canada since October 2016. Watch our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also link to the statement Senator McFedrin drafted together with 10 of her colleagues in late June, and a renewed call for a full Canadian arms embargo on Israel issued by Senator McFedrin and 25 of her colleagues on July 29th. Police repression go hand in hand with environmental and climate destruction. 22 months into Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, U.S. bombs and missiles have generated an estimated 40 million tons of concrete rubble, liberally seasoned with the toxic detritus and residues of U.S., British, and German munitions. Cleaning all this up, reducing it to a finer grade of toxic rubble, trucking it all off, will generate an estimated 90,000 tons of greenhouse gases. By some estimates, rebuilding Gaza, whenever that happens, will generate 30 million tons of earth-warming gases. Meanwhile, in Israel, USA, intellectual co-author and co-perpetrator of Israeli mass murder and destruction, Donald Trump's one big billionaire bailout bill threatens to pulverize America's fledgling renewable energy industry. Wind and solar energy budgets have been slashed. Trump's one big beautiful bill allocates $150 billion to ICE, Immigration Control and Enforcement. Heavily militarized and masked militia are now terrorizing Black, Brown, and Latino communities coast to coast. With me to talk about this is Aaron Kirschenbaum, War is Not Green organizer for the U.S. Anti-War and Justice Organization, Code Pink. Hello, Aaron Kirschenbaum. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me briefly about Code Pink and the War is Not Green campaign.
Yeah, so Code Pink is a feminist transnational organization that's been around for over 20 years, fighting US wars, occupation, militarism, and Western imperialism, and working to reallocate money to people's needs instead. We started around the Iraq War to sort of protest some of the co-optation of feminist rhetoric that was used to justify the invasion of Iraq, and have been working ever since on every form of expansion of US empire and movement away from people's needs. And the War Is Not Green campaign emerged because of an understanding that when it comes to the peace movement and the climate movement, these are sort of two movements that have, I think, especially in the context of the US, more than many other places, honestly, have sort of been deemed as separate movements. And I think you can go down a long line of reasons why, around funding structures, around sort of general norms and the separation, I think, that a lot of people within the US grow up having between when it comes to foreign policy and US expansion around the world. But often in climate spaces, we see discussion of war and militarism as sort of the elephant in the room. And that's to say that, the US military is the number one institutional polluter in the world. We have over 800 bases around the world in dozens of countries. And each one of those bases produces so much toxicity in the soil, in what it does to the land that it's built on, and violating indigenous sovereignty. And of course, war is often driven for the sake of extraction and continuing to extract oil or minerals or whatever, or tons of other resources around the world. And so the War Is Not Green campaign is a call to sort of unite the peace movement and the anti-war movement and environmental movements into one movement, because often struggles against militarism around the world are struggles for the land and for people. And so these are two movements that have been siloed apart from each other, but really shouldn't be. And so it's a call to unite and to join forces and to say that the only way that we can save the planet is to fight US war and imperialism.
And I've read the number that since the Second World War, wars that America has fought directly or that the United States has fueled and instigated, and the United States has been at war. I've read David Vine's book about permanent war in the United States. The United States has been at war since, we're really 1776. It's been at war for all but about 12 years. And in the course of the wars that have been fought since the Second World War, something like 20 million people have died as the result of U.S. wars. Now, so it's a huge human cost, but these wars destroy the planet, don't they? They wreck environments, they wreck natural environments, they pollute the atmosphere, they destroy the biosphere. Talk about this.
Yeah, no, I mean, we can only look towards at Gaza right now to see, I think, so much of this centralized, where the entire natural environment has been completely destroyed. A lot of folks in the environmental movement have called it ecocide, and ecocide there has been used as a tactic of genocide as well, in addition to being an effect of the ongoing bombardment. And you can see that in birth defects, in the rise of deaths pre-birth. You can see that in the long-term sickness that's been caused. You can also look at other cases, like in Vieques in Puerto Rico, which is an island off the coast of Puerto Rico that was in, I think, around the 50s, converted into a U.S. naval base and used as a bomb testing site. And a lot of those bombs would go on to be used on Palestine, but for folks in the island, that was part of, I think, the rates of cancer there are up to 150% more for some cases than the rest of Puerto Rico, up to 300% for some specific cases like lung cancer. And so, when it comes to the effects of war and bombing in localized areas like that, There's no concern for human life ever. And when it comes to the emissions, those are also absolutely catastrophic. I mentioned that the US military is the number one institutional polluter, but I think you can also look at the cases.